Travis Kalanick is out at Uber. Rafe Needleman is here to tell us why we should be nice to our machines. And how do you draw a circle in the air? Counterclockwise or clockwise? Learn about what it says about you on Tech News Today with so much more coming right up.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1794, recorded Wednesday, June 21st, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage just for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/TNT. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we tell you every last thing that you need to know about technology. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell has jury duty today. He is doing his civic duty and he will hopefully be back tomorrow. Cross your fingers. It's tough to do this without him, but I think we're okay because I have you. I have you and I have Brian, of course, too.
And don't forget Burke.
And Burke. Of course, Burke, who I can see out of the corner of my eye.
We got you, Megan.
Okay, thank goodness. Today, we opened the little Uber advent calendar window to the news that CEO Travis Kalanick is stepping down permanently. Last week, Kalanick announced a leave of absence, but now he says he's giving up his position as the head of the ride-hailing company after pressure from investors. Now, this is good news for Uber in their fight to shed their bro culture image. It's also hopefully good news for employees of the company, especially some female engineers and other employees who've reported repeated instances of sexual harassment that were ignored by human resources. And it's not all bad news for Kalanick either. He will keep control of a majority of the voting power at Uber, and he will even have a say in hand-picking his successor. There are a lot of rumors out there about who it will be. We don't know yet. According to sources, Kalanick was ousted as a boardroom coup led by lead investor Bill Gurley. And Kalanick is not the only one out today. A software chief at Tesla is also out, although he appeared to have left willingly. After only 6 months with the company, Autopilot VP Chris Lattner, former developer of the Swift programming language at Apple, is leaving Tesla. And he took to Twitter to say it was, quote, not a good fit. It wasn't a good fit, was his quote. Headquarters of Apple and Tesla, of course, only a mere 10-mile ride in a Model X away from each other. And the two companies have often been found poaching each other's employees. They've been doing that for a couple years now. In a statement, Tesla said AI expert Andrej Kaparthy will be the new director of AI and Autopilot Vision, where he will report directly to Elon Musk. As for Lattner, it looks like he will be fine. The replies to his tweet are chock full of job offers from places ranging from Twit sponsor Cloudflare to Cards Against Humanity. Personally, I think he should go back to work at Apple. They give employees free cookies, allegedly. So I have an Amazon Echo. I have three Echo Dots and an Echo Show on order. I'm kind of an addict. I have also been ogling Apple's HomePod coming later this year, and I sometimes think I ought to get a Google Home just because. And then I remember how annoying it is to hear my kids or my husband or myself yelling at these devices to turn off or turn down the music or just rudely responding when it has no idea what we're talking about. There's been some rumbling about how these devices might be teaching all of us, especially the young people among us, some very bad behaviors. Joining us to talk about this is longtime tech journalist and pundit Rafe Needleman. Welcome back to the show, Rafe.
It's good to be back. Good to see you guys.
So you write a great column on Medium about tech etiquette. So explain why we should be polite to our devices.
Well, I will first tell you that when I first saw people writing saying that we should be polite to our technology devices because it's teaching us and our children how important it is to be polite, I thought that was nonsense, that the most important thing to do is to teach people to be polite to other people and to know the difference between people and machines. And machines don't care, right? But then I start to realize that we're moving into an era of artificial intelligence where A, it's harder and harder to tell apart a machine from a person. So you don't sometimes don't know if you're talking to a machine or a person, especially on a customer support chat or email or eventually a phone call. So you might as well be nice because there might be a person there or it might be a machine. And sometimes a machine will be telling you it's a person. And sometimes actually a person will be telling you it's a machine and you just don't know. So why not be nice? More importantly, what if these machines get smart? What if they develop emotions? What if they are programmed to respond to our sentiment, to our emotionality in their own way? It doesn't hurt to be polite to machines because they might be recording all this stuff and remembering who's naughty and who's nice, and it could come back to bite us. Might as well play it safe instead of sorry. That's all. I agree.
But you bring up another point that I'd like an explanation of some etiquette. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have been on Twitter or sometimes different like chat places where I've been surprised to know that I'm speaking to a bot and not a human. What is the responsibility of a company to make it clear on Twitter or elsewhere, Facebook Messenger, that you are talking to a bot and not a person?
I'm going to cover that in a future column on Medium. I think it's a very interesting issue. My belief is that it is a responsibility of an AI to identify itself as such so that you don't misunderstand it as an emotional being and respond to it as if it's a person. It's weird when you're talking to something that doesn't have real emotions and it might respond in a way that confuses you or upsets you. So I think it's very important for a bot to identify itself as such. I also think it eventually is going to be important for people on chat, text chat in particular, where you're going to end up talking to a lot more bots, for people to identify themselves as real people. And the most important thing is that neither can lie. Sometimes a person might want to identify as a bot to deflect emotionality, and sometimes a bot might try to identify it as a person to engage a customer. I think both of those are wrong and fraught with problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, Burke, who is in our studio, is not a bot. He's a human who likes to communicate through small white index cards. He says, like what you said, the machines will remember. How will they remember? How will that work exactly?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, you guys got to keep in mind that this is just science fiction thinking for the future. I grew up on sci-fi, and I combine the sci-fi world with the real world. But again, it's the overhead of saying something nice to a machine is very low. I mean, I'll do it right now. You know, Alexa, turn off my office light.
What do you think that means?
Oh, for crying out loud. So much for live demos.
Don't be rude to her.
Hello. Please turn off my office light. Hello. Please turn off the office light.
Sorry, I didn't want to turn off the office light.
All right, I give up. You're a dope.
Sorry.
I'm going to get in trouble. You know, I ran through this like 9 times before I went on air, and it was perfect.
And it did work a second before when you turned it off. It worked off. Yeah. Or no, it turned back on. So Alexa has a mind of her own.
Yeah, there's Helen. Sorry, Dave, I can't do that. And Helen actually does have a series of responses for when you say nice things to her or it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, your question of, you know, so my sci-fi hypothesis is that whether it's Siri or Alexa or Google Home or you know, eventually Xfinity or Sonos or whatever, when you speak commands to them, they all go into a database, and the retention of that data, of the voice responses, varies depending on which company you're dealing with. You know, Google keeps it all for a long time. If you have this, Helen, you can turn off the microphone here so she doesn't get sensitive. sorry, didn't mean to tilt the screen down like that. If you have an Echo, you can go into the app on your mobile device, and you can actually play back all your interactions with the device, and then erase them if you want. If you don't erase them, they stay there for an unknown amount of time. But what if these responses, these dialogues that you have with the machines, are kept in a database for a while, and what if they are used to develop a profile of you? How you treat the machine could be just another data point. You know, this person is nice. This person is always angry. This person is a real jerk. And that could affect how the machines respond to you, the offers you get, the quality of service you get, who you're matched with if it's a matchmaking service, like, say, a ride-sharing service. So, like I said, it doesn't cost very much to be nice, and it feels really weird to say please and thank you, at least to me. It feels very strange to say please and thank you to a machine. But it's a pretty easy habit to get into, and I think the I did a little decision matrix in my chart. It's just it doesn't cost much, and it couldn't hurt. It might help, and it could hurt if you're a jerk, yeah. Just like it is, just like with people.
Exactly. Well, you know, the Echo seems to me like a child in some ways just now, just not, you know, your child does some amazing trick and then you have a dinner party and you you know, bring out the child and say, do the amazing trick for everyone, and they don't
very
do
much.
It. So, speaking of children, like your first thought on this was, well, we shouldn't be teaching our kids to be polite to machines, because we need to be teaching our kids that machines are different than people. I mean, one of the reasons that your article really spoke to me, my 12-year-old, you know, the weird conversations you have in the car with your kid, he just said, you know, if a robot were to hurt me, would you hurt the robot? He was like asking this sort of, is it okay to kick a robot? Is it okay to hurt a robot? What if a robot hurts me? And it's like, you know, a robot is not, you can't get revenge on a robot. Like, isn't there some message here that we should be teaching the next generation about really the difference between humans and machines?
I agree completely, which is why I originally was telling my 10-year-old that he didn't have to be polite to the machine no matter what anybody said, because the machine doesn't have feelings. It's just a machine that's been programmed by us to serve us, which sounds like the introduction to Battlestar Galactica. again, I'm going to be serious here for a second about emotionality. There is a science called sentiment analysis, which is used by call centers and marketing companies and all these, and it's on all these Twitter marketing software services that reads the sentiment, the emotional quotient of the user or the customer, and takes actions based on that. And again, if a marketing firm knows, as reading your sentiment, and knows that you are a certain way, that you are quick to anger, that you're just an angry person, they may not match you with a service that you would enjoy, because they know that you're difficult. Now, it is the case, you know, getting off track here just slightly, that if you are known to be an extraordinarily difficult customer with, say, an airline, they might treat you better because they don't want you to flip out at them and go on a Twitter rant. I think it's much more likely that if you are known to the algorithm as being a kind and nice and gentle person, you will get the service that a kind and nice and gentle person would get, which is probably what you want, not the service that somebody who's just always kind of a pain in the neck gets.
Yeah, one would hope that that's true.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to a Twitter or Siri or something like that, it's probably almost certainly not necessary, and it's just kind of amusing to think about. But again, as time goes on and we have more and more AI bots, whether they're voice or text or augmented or virtual reality bots, it's going to be more – very funny image. It's going to be more and more difficult to remember who we're talking to or what we're talking to or which company or which person. And I just think that politeness is easier to remember than trying to remember that, oh, this is my private bot, it doesn't matter. This is a human being, it does matter. This is the United Airlines customer service bot, and I really don't want to get stuck in a middle seat again. Right?
I agree. So are there any other machines that we should be polite to besides our digital assistants?
Well, you should always treat your tools with care. Because you're going to pass them down to your children.
Put
them back where they belong, put the silverware away, you know.
Yes, exactly. Everything you learned in kindergarten. You also wrote a tech etiquette piece on who should hang up first. I thought this was a great one. If you get disconnected, mm-hmm. Are you going to give us a spoiler? Do we have to read the column? But who, if I get disconnected and we're talking on the phone, who should call back first?
Oh, yeah. Caller calls back always. That when you're when two people are on a phone call and one disconnects, the person who placed the call always calls back. If you go down to the bottom of that story there, for those of us who are watching this on video, there's a matrix. And it's who called and who is the callee. And it's if everybody agrees that the person who called is the one who calls back when the call drops, we will have no problems. Otherwise, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. People get confused. They get angry. You know, they get everybody's call going to voicemail. Nobody actually talking to each other. It's just a simple rule. It's not that one way is more polite than the other. It's just if we remember it this way, if we remember to put the silverware here and we remember to call these people back when the call drops, things will go more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. And what I have one more etiquette question for you. What when you're trying to find someone and you call them and you're walking towards them with the cell phone and they're like, I see you. When is it appropriate to hang up the phone? Like right when you see the person, or do you have to say goodbye once you make eye contact?
That's a good question. I've wondered that myself. I'm putting that on my list. I've got about a list of about 100 tech etiquette questions that I'm going to answer over the course of this column in the coming period of time, weeks or months. And I'm adding that one. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your writing. It can be found on Medium at Rafe Needleman or at Rafe, just R-A-F-E at Medium and on Twitter. And you have a secret job at Cisco that you can't tell us about, but I'm sure you're doing amazing things and that we don't know about, but we do know that we can find you on Medium and Twitter. Thank you so much, Rafe.
It's good to talk to you. Thanks for the time.
Take care.
Bye.
Quick reminder that you can comment on anything we discuss by emailing tnt@twit.tv. And of course, you can subscribe to the Tech News Today podcast, video, audio, by going to our show page at twit.tv/TNT. After the break, we have some more news. Plus, start thinking about how you draw a circle. Think about it in your head, because I'm going to ask you in a minute. Right after I thank Rocket Mortgage, the sponsor of this episode. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home. Homes are expensive. They are probably one of the most expensive things you will buy in your entire life, unless you're flying to Mars or something. But it's scary too. You don't know what all these numbers mean, and you just need confidence to find the loan that's right for you. Rocket Mortgage is simple. You can fully understand all the details. Everything is explained right there. It is not as difficult as it seems, and you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's all about the confidence, and it's also about convenience. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button, and it's powerful. So whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 21st home, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that is just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/TNT. That's rocketmortgage.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Tech News Today. Before we get to our next interview, I want you to do something for me. I want you to draw a circle in the air with your finger. Just draw a circle in the air. Did you do it? Ready? Now, which direction did you draw the circle? Clockwise or counterclockwise? Whichever way you drew it tells a lot about you. Joining me to talk about what it tells about you is Nikhil Sanad and Tu Huang Ha, reporters at Quartz. Welcome to you both to the show.
Thanks for having
me. Hey, how's it going?
So I drew my circle counterclockwise. Does that make me a genius? We'll start with you, Nikhil.
I'm sorry to say that that makes you like most Americans. It doesn't really say anything special about you. The way what we found is that the majority of Americans draw circles counterclockwise, starting at the top.
And do you agree with this, too, or would you say I'm a genius?
You might be a genius, but this isn't the tell, I'm afraid.
So tell us a little bit about this data, where you got it, and how you looked into it and why.
Okay, I can handle that question. Basically, Google had this set up this game a little while ago called Quick Draw, where they would ask people to draw different kinds of shapes as quickly as they could. And the goal was for Google to collect data on how people draw things so that they could train their algorithms to recognize these objects. So there would be something like draw a circle or draw a camel or a horse or a cat, and Google would try to identify what you're drawing as you drew it. But the cool thing is that they open sourced all of these drawings. There were 50 million of them altogether. And Tu and I had the question of, could we identify some difference across countries in how people draw certain shapes? And we thought that we could look at circles because it's a very simple thing. There's really only two ways that you can draw it. You can either go clockwise or counterclockwise. And so we analyzed all of the about 100,000 circles that were in the data set, and we tagged them clockwise, counterclockwise, and we figured out which countries were more likely to go one way over the other way.
Was there a way, because you tell if people were using a mouse or if they were using like a pen and some sort of touch device, was that data included?
No, the data that we had was all of the XY coordinates that they passed through and the country that they were in. So we don't know how many people were on a certain device or another, but I think we could assume that it's would be a majority mobile phone users, because that's just the nature of the internet these days.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And what accounts for the difference?
So our hypothesis is that, well, you know, we asked ourselves the same question. Why, what could be the stark difference between the United States, for example, 85% going counterclockwise, and Japan, which is 80% clockwise? And one of the things that struck us, the difference between those two countries, is how they write. In the US, we write in English and we use the Roman alphabet, and that has a couple of curved letters that have letters going counterclockwise. So that's, you know, C, O, G. But in Japanese, there's a strict stroke order, which tells you what direction to create your strokes in. Generally, we can say, this is the same in Chinese, we can say top to bottom and left to right. And that includes some rules around the curves that appear in the script of hiragana in Japanese, which all, or the majority of them, go clockwise, these curved strokes. So that's our hypothesis.
So we have a lot of people, we have a live chat room that's listening to us, and they have a lot of people asking, like, what about lefties or righties? Does it matter if you're left-handed or right-handed?
It makes sense that it matters. The majority of the world is right-handed, and so that you know, there is some research that suggests that right-handed people naturally go counterclockwise. But I think what our analysis shows is that it could actually be more based in culture than we think.
Hmm. Yeah, I would just add to that and say that, you know, the number of the percentage of people that are left-handed or right-handed is not going to change that much from one country to the next. So you wouldn't expect there to be such a dramatic difference of 15% versus 80% clockwise in the U.S. and Japan. It's not the case that Japan has, you know, 80% of the people are left-handed and the U.S. 15% of people are left-handed or something like that.
So I think that what you're saying makes sense with the writing, but what, I mean, is this isn't really a random sampling. Right. I mean, it's people that know about Quick Draw, kind of would be like maybe a more techie sampling of people, people that, you know, that want to play this game with Google that have heard about it. Do you think that has anything to do with it? Like more technical people do go counterclockwise?
It's possible that our sample is biased toward people who, yeah, of course, know about the game. But what's interesting is that in our research, we found studies from the 70s, 80s, and 90s that were conducted in the U.S., and they showed that children children in the U.S. overwhelmingly drew their circles counterclockwise, and then as they got older, that got even more solidified. And that was also true, the reverse was true in Japan, that children, if you started at, let's say, first grade, it was kind of split, you know, maybe a third of the children went counterclockwise, a third went clockwise, and a third kind of did both. And by the time they didn't, it wasn't a longitudinal study, but they also studied children in the sixth grade at that time, and they found that overwhelmingly people, children were drawing their circles clockwise, more so than they had in the first grade.
Mm. So what else can we learn about this study besides, I mean, what can we draw from the fact that that Americans draw their circles, more likely to draw their circles counterclockwise?
Well, I would just add to the question about the sample or whether it's biased or not. I think another thing we can learn is just the way in which these scripts can have can produce similarities in people across countries and across languages. So we saw, if we analyzed right to left scripts that are written right to left as well. And you can see that even though we had, you know, thousands of circles for all of these languages put together, that all the right to left languages really group together in the number or the proportion of circles that are going one way or the other way. So, and the same is true for languages that use the Chinese script. So in that way, we can sort of see how these things, how the script and the language can transcend a national border and kind of form its own identity that way.
Mm. Which also gets at the question, the answer to your question, which is the takeaway is that we have all of these kind of hidden instincts or habits that we may not be aware of ourselves. The kind of the fun of the story was, and I think you found too, the fun of telling people about the story is so that they can figure out for themselves what's their habitual way of drawing shapes. And that could be for a number of reasons, but it seems to me that across the, you know, across the world that it certainly tracks by nation and by culture. And I think that's really fun for people to figure out.
Yeah, and as you write in the piece, that this sort of drawing shapes used to be more of a psychological tool, a way people would decide, are you normal or not? And we sort of done away with that. Do you think that that is one of the Google's goals? With, I know that they're using this information for machine learning and trying to teach, you know, machines how people draw pictures, and we've already seen some of the things that have come out of it, like Google's ability to determine when I draw, you know, a pig that it's a pig, or a shoe that it's a shoe. But do you think that does it make you wonder whether Google's using this for some sort of psychological purposes as well?
We never know what they're doing.
Yeah, we never know. I think I would say that it's really cool when a company like this releases data, especially to journalists, because I think that our job is very different from theirs. Theirs is to collect as much as they can and kind of throw some machine learning at it and figure out what that can find. And I think our job is more to put some pieces together and tell a story about things that affect specific people and what we can learn about ourselves from that data. And so I don't think that they have any sort of nefarious use, but I do think that their job is more about, you know, it's focused on big data, not so much of the storytelling aspect or learning aspect.
That's what you guys are for. So are you going to look into other data from the Google Quick Draw experiment, or have you moved on?
What do you think, too?
Well, I'm on vacation, so I've moved on in a way. But I think we are really open to, you know, seeing the response has brought up a lot of new questions. So I think we're open to looking at, you know, other forms that we haven't thought about before.
So to your beat on Quartz, what is it? What's your beat?
I write about books and culture.
Awesome. And Nikhil, how about you?
I sort of focus on this data-driven stuff and visualizations, data analysis, that kind of thing, and turn that into stories.
Awesome. Well, you can both be found at QZ.com. And do you have any place else that where people should follow your work?
I'm on Twitter at NKL. You could follow me there.
And how about you too?
I'm also on Twitter. I'm at Tu Hung Ha. That's Tuhunghha.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to talk to us, and we look forward to your work at Quartz. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Take care.
Take care.
You can pay your favorite YouTuber and you can pay your favorite Twitch live streamer, but if you are the number one fan of a Periscoper, you were out of luck until now. Today, Periscope owner Twitter announced Super Hearts, a way to send micropayments to your favorite Periscoper in order to support the creator and to get their attention. According to the company's post on Medium, it's a bit of a challenge to send these virtual gifts and for the creators to receive them. Each heart is worth a different value, and you can only buy or use them in iOS or Android. Also, you can only buy Super Hearts when a Periscoper is live. Currently, only U.S. Periscope creators have the abilities to cash out their gifts. So if you send gifts to someone who's not in the U.S., they can't do anything with them. The company says support in other areas is coming soon. If you can't wait and you really want to try this now, you can buy a coin package in the iOS App Store or the Google Play Store. According to The Verge, a Russian software company will now let you jailbreak your consumer drone to get past military and government-enforced no-fly zones. We don't recommend doing it. CopterSafe is making the software in response to DJI's increased flight restrictions. Brian, what do you think about being able to jailbreak your drone? Is that something you are interested in doing?
Not necessarily. Like, I'm not surprised that this has happened, but you know, like, if you really are that worried about not being able to fly one of your drone that you own in an area, you can always build your own. So you don't have to use a DJI if you like. You're like, because when you buy a DJI, it's a great like prepackaged drone, and then it comes with all the software stuff like no fly zones and things like that, which is great. And but if you're trying to get around that, you could always build your own, not necessarily like hack the software. So for me, like, it would be a lot of trouble to buy a DJI and then, well, I want to jailbreak it. I mean, people want to play with things that they buy, so I get it. But you can always build your own too.
So is it, I mean, you would get arrested, right? If you flew into a no-fly zone with your own pre-made drone, would you get, or ticket? You don't necessarily get arrested. You get fined.
Yeah, totally. You could get fined. You could get arrested, especially if you fly in a very vulnerable area. I know there was a time where it was like by the Golden Gate Bridge. You can only fly within like a, it's pretty far out from where you can fly a drone by the Golden Gate. And like there was a drone that somebody was flying, and then it pretty much started to drop out of the sky because it was not supposed to be in that area. So I don't know.
So do you think that government is being over-restrictive with these no-fly zones and that we should be able to fly? It's a free country. We should be able to fly anywhere? Or do you think these are for our safety?
That's a loaded question. Mm-hmm. We definitely have no-fly zones for a good reason. They already exist for airplanes and things like that. And especially with flying, like Alex Skumpel, who's a pilot here, has explained to me all the procedures and things that you have to go through so that there aren't air congestion, all the different tests that you have to take so that you can contact towers and things like that. And flying a drone is no different. There are places that are appropriate to fly it. There are places that you should never fly a drone. And if one of those ways is that they have to hardware or, well, in this case, firmware lock down no-fly zones, I mean, that's fine with me, but I can see why it might bug people. And there might be people who own these devices that say, well, I should be able to do whatever I want with them. And I totally get that too. But I think in my case, if there was somewhere that was maybe it was not designated, it was designated as a no-fly zone, but I know that it's okay because it's my property or something, I might just go ahead and build my own drone and then fly it anyway. And because I would be the one that would have to arrest myself. But I don't know. It's kind of a tricky question.
Well, Bleak in the chat room says you can pry your, or he's calling you Cranky Hippo, which is your handle. You can pry Cranky Hippo's open airspace from his cold controller-filled hands.
Bleak's absolutely right.
Okay, good to know. Hope I didn't put you in an awkward position here. It's
No, me and Patrick talk drones all the time, and I'm an advocate for building them yourself because it's fun. It's a cool project. But I also like the DJI drones, too. Like, they, if you're doing camera work, they're pretty cool, pretty slick.
And I assume you haven't tried the software, but it's not always the best idea to just install Russian software on your onto your DJI drone, right?
Why would that be a bad idea? I trust Russians.
Well, we got some feedback. Brian, B-R-I-A-N, not this Brian that we just heard from, writes, please stop saying that you need a 4K TV to get the benefits of the Xbox One X. While the obvious benefits come from 4K, users with 1080p display will get reduced load times across all Xbox titles and increased particle effects and super sampling on One X enhanced titles. Thank you, Brian. Yeah, I mean, 4K is really a term that we get spun around, gets thrown around a lot. I have a 4K TV, and I really don't even know if I'm watching things in 4K most of the time. Like, I don't even know. I know that I don't have my Apple TV connected to it because I know I can't watch 4K through there. But it's really, it is, yes, it's the Xbox One X is better than the than just for people with 4K.
I want to chime in on that one,
okay,
too,
okay.
Megan. Now that I'm on a roll.
Okay, I know. I heard you. I heard you give me a...
Which, I mean, it's fine. I understand Brian's point, other Brian, even if he spells it with an I
the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. It's just, if you're buying the Xbox One X, which is still a silly name, and you don't have a 4K TV, it's kind of like, I mean, maybe you're planning on getting a 4K TV later, but it's kind of overkill for playing games on a lower resolution. But also Scott Wilkinson and I think a few other people have talked about, like, HDR is kind of more of a big deal. So if you're going to be buying the latest console hardware and you want that experience, you should probably get yourself an HDR capable TV before, and then also a lot of them are 4K, and I think Burke's making a point.
Mm-hmm. I'll know it when I see it.
The only time I notice it is when I'm shooting stuff in 4K, but like if I'm sitting 8 to 10 feet away from a TV, it's kind of hard to tell between 1080 and 4K, but HDR does make a big difference.
At Leo's house, Burke says that's where that's yeah, he recently housed that while they were on vacation. So I don't know. So do I get Netflix in 4K? I feel like this is when I admit that I have Sprint. Like, I don't know. Is there a setting that I have? I have an Android TV. Is there a setting that I have to change in order to, or will it just know if 4K is coming in, 4K is going to go out?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly you have to have the bandwidth capable of it to begin with, but I don't know if there's like a setting in Netflix that you, I don't, because, Netflix content, Bert?
There's a Netflix 4K content.
Okay, so they specify certain ones that are in 4K. But, you know, I'm kind of the wrong person because I still have a 720 TV. I have a 50-inch 720, but it's plasma, and it looks good for what I do, like playing games and stuff.
Caillou in the chat room says Netflix charges $12.99 to access 4K content, so maybe my subscription doesn't even cover it. So
I thought $12.99 was the default streaming cost now without DVD.
I thought it was too, but I thought maybe I paid I think I paid $9.99 because it was up from $8.99, but I don't know. These are things we should know. Oh, we'll find out before tomorrow. I'm going to, so tune in tomorrow. TNT's fan of the day is Shubham Jain, who says, this is how I watch TNT, actually how I listen to TNT, thankfully, because he is riding a bike. So we hope that you are just listening and not watching while riding a bike. While commuting to work, #TechBreakfast, #SiliconValleyOfIndia. Thank you, Shubham. I'm hoping that I'm pronouncing your name somewhat correctly, and I am so glad that we are your tech breakfast. But you should also eat real breakfast, too, because there's not enough protein, I don't think, in this show. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. If you are looking for something to do this summer and you hate lanyards and kayaks, you might want to take part in the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Summer Privacy Summer Camp From now until July 4th, you can join EFF or renew as a Silicon Valley Silicon Level member for just $20. You don't even need a sleeping bag or a tent. You don't even need to get up off your couch. If you're part of the camp, you will receive a set of miniature printed field guides with shareable security tips covering how to defend your personal data at the border, digital security for protesters, surveillance, self-defense, and much more. Also, you will get a special edition embroidered patch that the EFF calls a digital civil liberties merit badge to add to your sash. I actually have my brownie sash at my desk, and I am excited to get my patch and add it to that because security is important. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 23 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Or you can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also hit us up on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV. You can also find us on our subreddit. That's technewstoday.reddit.com. Find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to show me how I can get 4K content on my new TV, I am at Megan Maroney. And thanks to our technical director and commentator, Brian. Thank you, Burke, for helping out in the studio, our index card commentator. And thank you to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We will see you tomorrow.